I'm too like Chris. It is a pleasure and an honor to be a part of your program. And besides that, it's much more of a pleasure and an honor for me to introduce your speaker tonight. He's one of the trustees for our program, a general service trustee from Canada, from Manitoba, Canada, and he went through quite an effort to get here. I was talking to him before the meeting and asked him how many times he changed planes, and he told me how he came, and I told him, remind me of that fellow on the corner that was telling that other man how to get to the post office, and when he got through, he just decided there wasn't any way you could get there from here. And he went through all of this to be here and be a part of our program, and we are very, very honored to have our trustee, Tom Grafton.
That's helping you up, you know. Thank you, Sam. I hope everybody is noticing that I brought my notes with me. I have to do that. I discovered some time ago that, you know, the purpose of carrying notes is so that you can ignore them. And that's kind of hard to do when you leave them at home. So you got to bring them. I got stuck on that once, and I never made that mistake again. What's this? You want it? All right. I can't see them anyway without my glasses. I don't need that. You're going to stay, are you? Everybody else, I don't know if you've noticed this, but everybody else who was up here tonight, as soon as they got through, they left. So I had visions of me being the last one here. My friend Jim is sitting down there in the front row, and he has a problem. Now and again he hears bells ringing. He used to do a little fighting. And I know that he had this experience a little while ago. He was motioning to me, but I assured him that it was not true. There were no bells ringing, so he relaxed. In November of 1950, Dr. Bob and Bill published a pamphlet. The name of the pamphlet was Our General Service Conference. And I would like to talk a little bit tonight about the pamphlet, because there were six reasons set out in that pamphlet for the establishing of the conference that I think we could all look at, perhaps with a little instruction at this time, 20 years later, you know. The six reasons that were given by our co-founders are as follows. One, Dr. Bob and Bill are not immortal. Two, our trustees are almost unknown to the AA movement. Three, somebody or something must take the place of Dr. Bob and Bill. AA has a right and a duty to take direct responsibility. Five, the General Service Board must be firmly anchored in the fellowship. And six, the General Service Board has a need of the direct support of the membership. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that pamphlet and those six reasons. And I'd like also to share with you the story of one alcoholic from hopeless, helpless drunk to trustee on the board, hoping that maybe in the sharing an identification can take place between you and I, which will be of a sort of personal nature to let you relate maybe a little closer to the board and make the board a little more meaningful to you. I think that perhaps the next 4 or 5 years are going to be of great importance to this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that you and I call home. We are now without the leadership of our co-founders. We're on our own. We have only one ultimate authority upon which we can rely. And it's up to you and I and all of the leaders and all of the trusted servants in Alcoholics Anonymous to carry the message, to set the example, and that's kind of a scary thought. And I'm awfully glad to be able to stand here tonight, and I'm really grateful to be here with the knowledge that I don't have to do this alone. It's been like that since the very first day I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've never been more grateful for that than I am standing here tonight and looking out over this crowd and seeing all these beautiful people here and knowing that we're all in this thing together with a common purpose and a common aim and a common objective. I don't know about you, but it sure gives me a real wonderful, warm feeling. I want to thank all the members of the committee who are responsible for my being here, because this is a real great thrill, I tell you, for a little country boy like me to be asked all the way down here to talk to this 28th meeting of the General Service of the conference, rather the Southeast Conference. We've had AA in our area for about the same length of time. We will be celebrating our 28th conference come October in Manitoba. Our anniversary actually is not until November, but we always like to get off the mark a little ahead of time, so we have it in October, you know. No alcoholic ever wanted to wait for anything in his life, and we're not any different, I can assure you of that. I had a little fun getting here. You know, in the summertime, our kids show up. We got a lot of kids, and they came around last night. So, as always, I am what they call self-employed. That's sort of a euphemistic phrase. It means that I work when I have to, you know. And so I got home late from the office last evening, and when I arrived home, all the kids were there, the children and the grandchildren. And they were playing chess, and they were yakking it up and eating everything in the fridge, you know. And they left about 1:30 this morning. Now, my flight left at 4:40, and we live like 25 miles from the airport. And I had asked my second son to drive me there. Would mean leaving home around 3:30, 3:45. That's about the time he gets in, so it doesn't disturb him too much to drive me, you know. And he readily agreed. Because he then gets to keep my car while I'm gone, see? Otherwise, he drives his own. So we got off the mark, and 1,500 miles later, we're in Toronto, and then we fly back to London, then we come across Lake Erie to Cleveland, and we change airlines. We go through customs there, and of course, I show up, but my bag doesn't show up. So that's always a kind of a thrill, you know. By the time I got here, I was a little concerned, but this committee are fantastic. They had a fellow, I don't know his name, that is his last name. His name is Charlie, but he's a young fellow, and he met me there, and he 12-stepped me right off the bat. He pointed out to me that the slogan of this conference is serenity through sobriety, and he asked me if I was sober, and I allowed I was. So he pointed out to me the other part of it, the serenity part. He said, don't worry about your bag. And I was a little nervous. I came in here, you know, and this morning, and all the people were here, and you sort of get that feeling. And I went back to the hotel. I was going to lie down and have a little rest. And Charlie left me there with some beautiful words of advice. He said, you know, we're not alone in this deal, and we don't have to worry about those things. He said, you just go lie down, don't worry about a thing, and your bag is going to be here when you need it. I woke up about 4:30, and I thought, you know, Charlie is a living, walking example of a great need for step two. Pick up the phone, call the bell captain. He says, yeah, it's right here. He brought it up. So here I am, and if I'm beautiful, that's why, you know. Or at least partly why. I was not completely ignorant of the existence of this beautiful little city. The setting here is fantastic. I noticed coming in on the plane this morning, the confluence of the rivers is very much like Winnipeg. We have two rivers that join, like your two here. I don't remember the names of them now, but we have a river called the Red. It reminds me very much of your river, exactly the same color. Muddy as blazes. I imagine the consistency of the water is about the same. And then we have another river called the Assiniboine. One of the gals at GSO had difficulty when she was out in Winnipeg pronouncing that.
She still calls it the Athabone River. We had a baseball club in Winnipeg called the Whips. They were well named. You people in Charleston here had a team called the Charlies. And I remember those fantastic pitchers you used to bring up in the International League to Winnipeg and mow us down and whip us every time. I remember a young fellow by the name of Bruce Kyson. We called him, I understand you call him Keeson. Now Bruce has gone on to fame and fortune. So I felt kind of at home here when I got here, seeing the rivers and knowing about the baseball and all that, and then meeting Charlie and meeting all the people here and my good friend Bob, of course, with whom I've corresponded for some time. I thought Bob would like to know that as a result of his invitation to come here, you just ruined my summer. Working on this, you know, I'm not the greatest NAA, and I don't intend to invade the rubber chicken circuit or anything like that, but I really do enjoy coming here and sharing some of the thoughts I have with you about the fellowship and about the program. My name is Tom Grafton, and I am an alcoholic. There's absolutely no doubt about that. My wife has never once suggested that I was in the wrong place when I was going to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. She never indicated that she thought it was anything else than alcoholism. And neither did anybody else, I might tell you. I came very close to being pitched out of every sort of organization that is connected with any legal society. I came very close to being pitched out of my own firm. I've since reorganized it, but in those days it was absolutely terrible. The familiar drinking pattern that we all have. I don't need to go into horrendous detail about that. But I was very, very fortunate, you know. At one point in my life, I met a man who had some positive answers. And that was the great saving grace for me. I started drinking, I suppose, for the reason that is given to us in the big book, eh? It says that most people drink because they like the effect, and I suppose that's what it was for me. I wasn't particularly young when I had my first drink. I took my first drink when I was about 17 years of age. I was, at that time, going to school in California, which seems perhaps a little strange for a fellow from Manitoba, Canada. But I was a big, strong, handsome young fellow in those days. Haven't changed a hell of a lot. And I was an athlete, you know, and I had a hockey scholarship to play hockey, of all places, in California. One of the colleges down there, it's called Loyola, St. Ignatius Loyola. That's a Catholic university. They have an order of priests there called the Jesuits, and they're the worst kind. Father was up here giving the opening prayer tonight. And he didn't mention what particular order, but I always like to give a little free publicity to the Jesuits. I feel that in my life they certainly have earned it. I'm, of course, being utterly facetious because, thank God, they instilled in me certain principles which are, oddly enough, identical with the principles that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that strange? I noticed, and I was told by the pages of AA Comes of Age that Sam Dowling, Father Dowling, pointed out the similarity that existed between the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola and the 12 steps of our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got an indoctrination there. When I arrived at that university, the first thing they did was give me a sponsor. And they called him a sponsor. I didn't realize, of course, until years later, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and getting a sponsor in this fellowship, that I've had sponsors all my life. I suppose my first sponsor was my father, but I rejected him. You see, I thought he was trying to run my life, and I was not about to submit to that. I wanted to be independent. I didn't want anybody to run my life, up to and including God. And I was not going to brook any interference from my father. It amounted almost to an obsession with me to be independent. So after about the age of 14, any degree of communication that my father and I had had largely disappeared, and that was not his fault, that was my fault. This chap they gave me at Loyola University was a Jewish fellow. His name was Eddie Becker. He was the head piano player over at MGM Studio, and he got me over there, and I got a little work through him, of course, and coming from a very sheltered atmosphere in a very sheltered home in a small town in western Manitoba, the population of which was maybe 300 if you counted all the dogs and cats as well as the people, you know. And I was sort of walking around completely mesmerized by this tremendously sophisticated atmosphere in Los Angeles, in Culver City, where the studios were. I had a good friend, his name was Barton. He had been chosen to play the part of Tom Sawyer in the movies, and as a result of this windfall of money that came along with it, he and his father had purchased a nightclub, which was on Washington Avenue, directly across from MGM Studios, at 9090 Washington Avenue, so with great rapier-like wit, they called it the 9090 Club. And we spent a lot of time there, and I was indoctrinated into a drink called the Bula Bula. It's rum and coke. And I got to know all the midgets that were working in the Wizard of Oz, and they're fantastic little people. They have a metabolism. They have a metabolic rate that is different than ours, so they can eat more and drink more without the same effect we have. But, of course, I didn't know that at the time, and I tried to drink with these birds, and, you know, if you see a little bitty guy like that, you're sure as hell not going to admit that he cannot drink you now, are you? Not if you're a red-blooded Canadian, you're not, I'll tell you. And I was red, and I was drinking, and I got into trouble. I recall my friend Eddie wanting to take me into his home and wanting to show me something about life and act out his part as a sponsor, inviting me over to his home to a party. And to this party, he had invited many of the people from the studios, from Hollywood. I remember one chap there was the first mayor of Boys Town. His name was King Lee. Came from Omaha, Nebraska, or at least had been there. And I was up in Omaha not long ago. And, yeah, by God, you didn't know this, Bob, but I'm an admiral in the great Navy of Nebraska. How do you like that? That's not bad for a drunk, eh? They had the lieutenant governor of the state induct me. I thought they were putting me on until I saw the, you know, their sort of serious look on their faces. Then I knew he wasn't putting me on. So I got the scroll at home to prove it. So I've been demanding a little more respect around my home group. I haven't been getting it, but I've been demanding it, you know. So then he invited me over to this party, and I knew these people were going to be there, and I looked forward with great anticipation, you know, like an alcoholic does. To me, that party was bigger than life, and I went over there all dressed up in a board pair of pants, scared as hell. Got there, looked over the people. There were quite a number there. Ed took me in, introduced me to this one or that one, but I was really shy and reserved as I was. And I kind of hid back behind one of the pod palms just to see what was going on. And there was a man there who caught my eye almost immediately. He was a short fellow, but he was very imposing. He was possessed of tremendous self-confidence, and he had the ability to deal with and talk to all of these sophisticated, chic, suave, beautifully dressed and beautifully groomed-looking people in whom I stood of awe, and they all appeared to defer to him, I suppose because of his position, you see. And I was watching this guy. I couldn't take my eyes off him. And I thought, it'd be great, wouldn't it, to be able to deal with people like that, you see. A couple of the other people who were there were Robert Taylor and Barbara Stanwyck, and they were so beautiful I couldn't take my eyes off them. They were just gorgeous. There was another man there who had on a white coat, black trousers with a stripe down the side. He was passing out a tray full of drinks, and I took a drink. Never had a drink before. And I drank it, and I was immediately consumed by a very warm and expanding and likable and reassuring glow. I could feel it permeating my whole being, and it felt so good, I couldn't wait for him to come back with another one, and I could have a little more of that treatment, you know. And after three or four of these things, these drinks, things began to happen and things began to change. I walked over to that little pipsqueak of a director and started to point out to him some of the inadequacies in his directing technique, where some of the more obvious improvements that he could make. which would, you know, make his films much more acceptable and more saleable and so forth. And after there had been some words with him, he didn't seem to appreciate, much to my dismay and surprise, he didn't seem to appreciate at all what advice I was giving him. I walked over to my old friends Bob and Barb and got talking to them. We had a little social discussion. I was having a little trouble being social because by this time I was having a little trouble being vertical. You know, at 17, after 4, 5, 6, whatever it was they were drinking, suddenly things began to change. The horizon began to tilt. Things were happening with my mouth that I had never experienced before, you know. But I was determined to be social. Well, you know what happened. I got into a real argument, which eventually resolved itself into a fight with the barman, and I went flying out the back door of the place. Got sick on the lawn, passed out, back to university in disgrace. Real disgrace. I don't remember ever feeling so disgraced before in my life as I felt the next morning when I came to and hazily started to try to reconstruct the events of the evening before. But for some reason that I couldn't understand, there were blank spots that I couldn't fit. There would be snatches of someone's face remonstrating with me, giving me advice, saying, don't be like that or something, you know. And then something else would come along, and there'd be a blank spot in there that I wouldn't remember. And it was a long, long time before I got around to the point where I could realize that alcoholism is a disease and not a disgrace, because it was a disgrace to me for a long, long time. A long, long time. My sponsor came around the next morning. He was a real fine guy. He took me down along the Delray Plaza, out along Santa Monica Bay in his convertible, and explained to me that people don't act like that even in Hollywood, and suggested to me that I shouldn't do those things anymore. And I agreed with him, and I didn't for about 2 weeks. And, you know, then something else happened, and I recall at the end of the hockey season, we had a kind of a graduation thing, was celebrated at a place in Los Angeles called the Chez Paris. And at one point in the proceedings of the evening, I became very ill, went out into the parking lot to relieve myself of whatever it was that was bothering me. The only problem was that inadvertently I threw up in the back seat of somebody's convertible. And the next thing I knew, there was a large minion of the law, Los Angeles' finest, standing there with his Sam Brown belt around his shoulder, and he immediately inflicted upon my person one of the acts of police brutality that I later came to know a little more firsthand, you know. And I landed up in the bowl, in the common goal. They threw me in Lincoln County Jail. I'd never been in jail before, and I thought, my God, that's terrible, you know. What an indignity to inflict on a well-intentioned, good-looking, handsome young fellow like me. I never intended to get into any trouble. I didn't start out to make any sort of problem for these people, and here he is picking me up and throwing me in the jail, you know, with all those Mexicans and Chicanos and colored guys and all those, you know, what it's like. Bucket in the corner and everybody throwing up and all them drunks. And I wasn't like that. I didn't think I was like that. But later in my life, I came to see that that was exactly me, and I wasn't in the wrong place at all. I was in the right place. And I was there for largely the same reason that those other people were there. And I discovered something, that alcoholism doesn't come in bottles, rather. It does come in people. So it doesn't matter, does it, what color or race or creed or God knows what. If you got that big hurt in here and you got no answers for it, and we got no power to carry on with life like our friend here was reading just a few minutes ago out of the big book, then you're going to undergo experiences of that kind. That sort of thing carried on during my sojourn in California. I lost my first job there because of drinking at the age of 18. One other thing happened to me there that always stuck in my mind, and it was kind of an odd thing maybe. There was a priest at that university who taught religion. He was very learned and very sincere and earnest and understanding, and I'm sure a very holy man. His name was Father Johnson. And Father and I were good friends because he used to supply me with a little money, and he used to supply me with cigarettes, and he took pity on me and like that, you know.
Every morning I'd meet him at the refectory door as we were going in for breakfast, and we'd transact our business for the day. And how this point came up, I have absolutely no recollection. Couldn't account for it at all. But he said to me, now this would be about 1939 or something like that. He said to me, there is an organization which has gotten started back east. And I don't know the name of it, but it's for helping drunks. It's for drunkards. And I felt some kind of a stab. Now, I don't know whether it was remorse or recrimination or guilt or what it was, but why did it hit me, you know, naive, innocent little 18-year-old boy? I never forgot that. Looking now on the reel of my mind, I can see Father Johnson's face and I can see his lips moving as he enunciates the words. That stayed with me always. I thought about it again after I got back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back to Canada from there for the same reason that many Canadian boys did. I came back to join the Air Force. I was going to become a fighter pilot. I was going to become an ace. Never occurred to me that I would be anything else. And we were going to win the war, and it wasn't going to take very long for that to happen. Unfortunately, you know, things didn't turn out like that at all. I did get into the Air Force. I did not get to be a pilot. I got to be a navigator. The reason I didn't get to be a pilot was because I got drunk, put my hand through a mirror. The story I used to tell was that I was defending one of my friends who was attacked by a... In those days, we had Americans coming up to Canada, not as draft dodgers. We had them coming up to join the Air Force. They were flyers. They had the Eagle Squadron. They were fantastic people. As they said, we're up here to teach the Englishmen how to talk and to fly. They caught them. You know, some of the little boys from Carolina and Texas, the way they speak English. When you get an Englishman from England, it's a rather interesting experience. They're both speaking the same language, and neither one of them can understand a damn word the other one is saying. So we acted as interpreters, you know. Actually, what happened was I got drunk. I was out on a 24-hour pass, and I came back to the barracks. And walking into the ablution room, to the washroom, in a drunken state, looking in the mirror, washing off my face, I suppose I'd been throwing up or something like that. Or maybe I'd been in a fight and was washing blood off. I don't know. Now I don't remember. But looking in the mirror and seeing this drunken face leering back at me and realizing that this was my face with those red eyes and those loose lips and that disgusting, sallow look. Purely reflex action, I drew back my hand and drove my fist through the mirror. Went through two mirrors because there they were back to back. So I had, I don't know, 48 or 58 stitches or something in my hand, and you know, they won't let you fly an airplane like that. So I missed the course, landed up in navigation school, and became a navigator. Went through the usual routine that guys go through in the war, you know. Wouldn't that be an interesting chapter? My war experiences, wouldn't that be great? Well, it wouldn't be really true, you know. I had planned. I usually, when I start out, I make two confessions that I normally make. The first one is that it's not going to be very long before you'll find out that about half of what I tell you is not true. And the second confession is that I have absolutely no idea which half it's going to be. I didn't lose any range or anything like that as a result of drinking, but I got shoved off into jobs that had no meaning. And so in order to bolster my ego, I used to give them meaning, you know. I would hook myself onto programs and make them very important. I had a wing commander who would be like a colonel, I suppose, come into my office one morning. So far as I was concerned, I'd never seen him before in my life. And he said, "Well, Tom, I'm ready." And I said, "Fine, ready for what?" Well, he said, "What we were talking about last night." And I said, "Oh, were we talking last night?" He said, "Well, yeah, don't you remember?" And I said, "No, I don't remember a damn thing about it." But he said, "You were describing to me the structure and the manufacture and the operation of a magnetic map board." And he said, "We have great need for this on the interior staging route, and I would like you to sit down and give this to our engineers." I said, "Well, I'd be very happy to do it if I only knew what a magnetic map board is. I've never heard of it. I've never heard of it since. I don't know where the hell the idea came from, you know." So See, I didn't have too much trouble with step two when I got through this program. Took me 5 days to get back after the war was over, after VE Day. And they said, well, you can all go home now. They gave us other orders. We were free to come home on the train, and I'm sending a telegram a day. You know, we'll be home tomorrow. We'll get on the train tomorrow. 5 days to get out of Vancouver. I don't know what I did. I can't remember where I was. I have no earthly idea of what I was doing, except the only thing I do know is that I was drinking. Full-time occupation. I was 24, 25. I was 25 that fall, that December. I got home. My wife said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I think I'll become an insurance executive. I had an offer from one of our larger life insurance companies. And I was with that life insurance company for exactly 1 week. I was drunk every day, came home every night drunk. At the end of the week, my wife said, well, you've just completed your career in the insurance business. You're going back to school. You're going back to law school. That's what you've always wanted to be, and that's what you're going to do. So Monday morning, I put my books under my arm, the unwilling school boy, and went off to school. Well, law school was kind of a lifesaver for me because we had to do about 5 years university in about 2.5 years. So there was no time for drinking. The discipline of the thing kept me sober, and I was study all the time. But I was so impressed by what was read before the meeting tonight, you know, that over any period of time, we never get better. The thing always progresses and gets worse. And this is true, you know, even if we're not drinking. Because I didn't have a drink, literally, for that 2.5, 3-year period that I was in law school. And yet on the night that I graduated, you know, with my keen alcoholic mind, graduated in the top fifth or fourth of my class with honors, we had a party, there was a celebration, there was drinking. I recall very clearly going to the party, I recall very clearly the first few drinks, and then I don't recall anything. Until suddenly came to consciousness again, sitting in the police station, with a friend of mine who had conducted part of our law course, he was a very senior police official, sitting across from me, feeding me coffee and saying, how did it happen? And I'm saying to him, you know, all sorts of ridiculous excuses. But the consciousness hit me, and I said to him, what are you talking about? How did what happen? Well, to make a long story short, I had been arrested by two cruiser patrol officers for breaking and entering. Now, that's not so terrible. You know, if somebody gets drunk, they could break and enter a store. But what really bruised my ego was the fact that the store at which I'd been arrested for breaking and entering was absolutely empty. There was nothing in it. Keen alcoholic mind, you know, the things don't go together. Here's an honor graduate in acting like that. How come? The pattern doesn't fit at all. You see, the pattern of behavior. So I identify, when I think about the alcoholic being born, with a pattern of what the world should be like in his heart, and then looking out at the world and seeing it's not like that, and not being able to stand it. So I was about, I suppose, in drinking to change everything. But nothing changed for the better, it always changed for the worst. After law school, things sort of ticked along, you know, a little more time, a little more money, got into a little bit of politics, got into a few athletic endeavors, the Canadian Amateur Hockey Association, things like that. And gradually the drinking became more and more and more, controlling my life. You know, I didn't see it that way then. I didn't think about it like that then. I put it down to things like persecution and lack of understanding and lack of appreciation on the part of my wife and my partners for all I was doing for them. I felt very badly dealt with. If only somebody could understand how I felt. That's how I felt, you know. But of course, I know very well that's not how my wife felt. I know now that's not how she felt. I didn't know then, you know. But I think now of those evenings when she would be feeding supper to the children at maybe 6:30 or 7 o'clock. Dinner's supposed to be at 5:30, 6 o'clock. Answering all those questions, you know, where's Dad? Where's the old man? How come he's not home for dinner? He wasn't home last night either. What's going on? And then getting the children to do their homework and getting the children off to bed and looking after the baths and the clothes and all the things that have to be done, getting the dishes done, cleaning up the kitchen and all the work that has to be done. 9 o'clock, everybody's in bed but Mother. 9:30, she's starting to look out the window, wondering where old Father is and what possible trouble he could be into tonight. 10 o'clock comes along, and she's starting to get really rather worried. 11 o'clock, she says, I wonder if I should phone the police station or the hospital. By 11:30, she's ready to phone the police station. At 12 o'clock, she says to herself, I hope he's not killed in an accident. At 12:30, she says, if he's not killed in an accident, I'm going to kill the son of a bitch myself. At 1 o'clock, Father walks in, just going, you know, a hazy little sort of aroma emanating from his person. And Mother says, where have you been? And she gets that terribly intelligent response that all alcoholics have. What do you mean, where have I been? See, now there's a very intricate, complicated English language question. Where have you been? I never had an answer for it because I never knew where I had been. Who were you with? I don't know. What were you doing? I don't know. How can you be doing that 5 nights a week? See? You were not learning, but the message wasn't coming through to me. So by 1:30, the war is over, and I'm in the bed, sound asleep, and Mummy's sitting there jangling. 2 o'clock comes, she still can't get to bed. 2:30, 3 o'clock, she's still pacing back and forth, looking at the kids, wondering about what's happening, you know. Then the next morning, the alarm goes off, 6:45, Father's out of bed, with a little help from Mother, and he cocks his eye at her, and he says, what the hell's the matter with you? You don't look very friendly this morning. I didn't find out these things from Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out these things from Al-Anon. They showed me the other side of the coin, and I'm very grateful to Al-Anon for all the things they taught me, you know. I'm absolutely certain that our co-founders had Al-Anon in mind when they wrote the big book. I'm sure of that. Because we have a phrase in our big book which I think, I'm told, describes Al-Anon beautifully. It says, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And that kind of fits. But I do remember having a little talk with my wife, maybe a year after I'd been in AA, and saying to her, you know, what was it like? And her saying to me, well, the thing was that I never knew where you were. I could never depend on you. Anytime I wanted you for anything, you were never there. That would be the time that you would not be there. And I said, well, did you notice any change when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, I think at that point in my sobriety, I was hoping that she might say, yes, after about the third or fourth month, I began to notice a faint glow over your head, you know, somewhere. But that isn't what she said. She said, yeah, you smelled a lot better. And she said, I usually knew where you were, and if I didn't know where you were, I knew that you were at an AA meeting or you were with AA people. So there was a bit of a difference, I guess. I recall, this was one of those occasions when I've been drinking for a few days, and I have kind of a favorite little sister-in-law. Her name's Leah. She lives in Amarillo, Texas, and she had phoned me from Texas to tell me she was coming to Winnipeg. And she gave me the day and the date and the time that the plane was arriving, and she asked me if I would meet the airplane, and I said I would. So life went on, of course, and I went on with my little drinking thing, and I arrived home one morning about 6:30, which was not that unusual, with a friend of mine. Now, this guy was not a friend of my wife's or a friend of my family. He'd never met them. And, of course, he hadn't met me till maybe 4 or 5 hours earlier. And we were sitting at the table drinking rye and coffee. My wife is French. Our family is French. So we used to call this Café Royal, royal coffee. See? Big deal. And being a lawyer, I always had to be presentable going to my office, and I had to get rid of those shakes and sort of steady down, do a little shaving, change my shirt, and have a couple more belts of this royal coffee. See? So I'm sitting there doing this when my little sister-in-law walked out of the bedroom, out of one of the bedrooms. And I said to her, my God, Leah, what are you doing here? She said, well, I've been here for 7 days. You know? You see, I lived in that house. That was my home. And I was in that home every day. Now, how the hell I could be in that home every day and not see her, I don't know. Our timetables didn't jive very well. But I was, and she was. It never occurred to me at that moment that this was not quite kosher, that this was not sane, that this was not normal. See, if anybody had asked me at that point, how do you get along with your family? Are you separated from your wife? What? Me separated from my wife? My God, no, I'm a good provider. If I'm a good provider, you know. Never occurred to me that I wasn't fulfilling my role as a husband and a father completely. I thought I was probably one of the examples, because I was down at the parish church almost every Sunday, or thought I was. I was the greatest novena starter in the history of the Roman Catholic Church. Novena is a prayer that you make on 9 consecutive days. I started a million of them and I never finished one. Who the hell can stay sober for 9 days? You can't do it, you know. And I'd blow it, so 2-3 days later, start another one, and I'd get holier in each progressive day, you know. I had a kind of a pattern. The pattern of my drinking by that time sort of went something like this. I'd go to the retreat house and get all holy. I got so holy there once they asked me to leave. You know, that's real spiritual experience, I want you to know. They had a deal there, you know, where you could write your name and put it in a box and then the priest would come and see you in your room. Well, you know, no alcoholic could resist an opportunity like that. See, not going to be like one of those common sinners and going to kneel in that public confessional. Have Father come to my room. And by the time he got there, you know, I had about a half a Mickey in me. That's a pint, about half a pint. And I was very full of the Holy Spirit. I knew I was a sinner, you know, worse than any sinner had ever been in the history of the church before. And I couldn't understand how it was possible that a human being could walk around with this load of mortal sin on his shoulders. You know, the ability we have to build things up. Eh? By the time poor old Father walked in, he was a little bitty guy. By the time he walked in, I was on my knees, and I had his hand in my hands, and I'm slobbering all over, and I'm trying to kiss his hand. And, you know, if it was bad, he wouldn't have got a better reception. I want you to know. And he looked at me and said, you know, Tom, I don't think you're very well. He said, I think you're a little ill. And shortly, the bursar came down and said, Tom, I really think that this retreat is a little emotionally more than you can handle in your present condition, and we think it would be nice if you packed up and went home. So I did. Of course, they were all wrong. They just didn't understand me, you know. When I got through with the retreat house bit, I'd go get drunk, seriously, you know. Quit fooling around with this nibbling and things like that. Then that meant a little sojourn in the hospital, maybe 10 days, maybe 14 days. Never for alcoholism, of course. Double pneumonia was a good one. Pressure, you know. I just forget the name they call it, but whatever the medical name was, it meant nervous pressure from work and like that. That's what I was suffering from. Get there drunk, leave drunk. See? Then the police was the next thing. Of course, another drunk in between the hospital and the police, and then back to the retreat house. So it went like that, you know. Drunk, retreat house, drunk, hospital, drunk, police. Drunk, retreat house, drunk, hospital. 4 times the last year I drank. It was great. A really satisfying way to live. There gets a point where you feel like a squirrel in a cage, and you look at it and you say to yourself, where in hell am I going? What's happening to my life? It's slipping through my fingers. And nothing has any meaning. It's like being invited to a banquet. And there on the table spread before you are the most beautiful silver dishes you've ever seen. The soup tureens, the meat servers, the salvers, the whole bit all covered. Gorgeous. And as you uncover each dish, you see that each one is filled with sawdust, trying to live the life of an active alcoholic. It's no wonder to me when I call on that guy who's sick and shaken, got the beard and the red eyeballs and the whole bit. There's that kind of lost look in his eye. I know what he's looking for. And I know that he hasn't got the foggiest notion in God's world how to find it. Aren't we lucky? How lucky can you get? I'm absolutely sure that we are the most fortunate segment of the entire human race. That we, this hopeless bunch, could get provided with an answer which would put power in our lives by means of which we can live. I hope I never cease being grateful for that. I've been drinking for maybe 7, 8, 9 days. I was a great old 7, 8, 9 dayer, I tell you. And I landed up in the pub. You know, I used to go to the office early. I'd get there maybe 7 o'clock, something like that. And I'd work like hell till 11. And there was a little cloth in the back of my head that went off and said, work's over for the day. So I'd drum up some kind of an excuse to get to a meeting or God knows what. An imaginary court motion, anything at all, to get out of the office and get into the bar. They weren't bars, they were beer parlors, and I hated them. They were stinky places, but it was all you could get, you know. So I went there, or a bootlegger, and I didn't like bootleggers either. The reason I didn't like them was not that I had any moral qualms about it, but they were policed regularly, and of course, practicing all the police, you know, it wouldn't do, see. Although some of our judges used to have their own. That's another story. I went into this evil, stinking beer parlor. About 11 o'clock in the morning, spent the whole day there. They closed in Manitoba at 6:30. That said, they don't encourage alcoholics. Didn't make any difference. The Alkies, you know what they did. They just bought 4 or 5 bottles of beer or a Mickey or a God knows what and whipped into the Biffy and sat and drank in there. I think Manitoba had the only hotels in the world that had upholstered seats in the toilets. So you could drink comfortably, you know. And then at 6:30 when the thing closed, I went over to a private club, of which I was still a member. It was the only one that I was. The others had all suggested that I move on. And I did. Hoping perhaps that I might see a friend of mine. He's a doctor. And I thought maybe he could help me. I thought he might have something to say that would explain life a little bit to me. You know, give me an answer of some kind. And I walked into that place, I was all alone. It was just me and the bartender, a little limpy-legged fella, but a kind man. He brought me 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 double scotches, something like that. You know, like every alcoholic, I always drink doubles. And I'm sitting there drinking these things and thinking about absolutely nothing in the world except that perhaps this chap might come along. No conscious train of thought whatsoever. I leaned over to pick up one of these glasses, and from the time the glass left the table till it got to my lips, something happened to me. I can't describe it. I don't know what it was. It felt physically as though something had turned over inside of me. It was a physical feeling. But I felt completely different. It was as though sudden clarity had come to my eyes and I could see every grain in the wood in the wall, for instance. And I could see the wrappings of the wire on the rung of a chair as though through some kind of a microscope. Tremendous clarity of vision. And at the same time, the thing that really struck me was I didn't have to drink anymore. And I was filled with absolute certainty from head to toe. As though I'd been poured full of it. That was all over. That was my last drink. And thank God, to this day, it has been my last drink. That was the 27th of May, 1960. So that's why I say that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sober today. By the grace of a loving God and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that miracle followed very shortly thereafter. I went home, I went to bed, I slept for 8 hours for the first time in many, many months. My wife looked at me, she said, will you have some dinner? And I said, no, thank you, very politely, which was new. First polite thing with sobriety. Got up the next morning again, it was Saturday morning, it was not my custom to go to the office, but I did so. Around 11 o'clock, one of my partners came in. Today he's a judge. Name's Louis. Hell of a guy. I called him into my office. I said, Louis, something's happened. I've got to tell you something. He said, what's wrong? I said, well, I don't think anything's wrong now. But I said, I've been away for 2 or 3 days. He said, oh, have you? I didn't notice. I said, oh, yes, you did. I've been away a hell of a lot lately, and you know what I've been doing. He said, what do you mean? Isn't that funny? They don't want to hurt us, you know. Why wouldn't he tell me? If it had been him, believe me, I would have told him. Quickly. Didn't want to do that. He looked kind of scared. See? I said, hey, I'm all through drinking. I'm all through. It's different. I've quit a million times. I didn't say I'd quit. I said, I'm all through. Tears came into his eyes. He grabbed me by the hand, shook my hand, didn't say a word, turned around, walked into his office. And I didn't know this, but he went and got my other partner, Walter, and told him. And he said, you know, I think something is different this time. He didn't tell me that. I found that out months later. I sat down at the telephone. I knew a man. His name was Russ. And I phoned him, and he was home. And I said, Ross, could you come to see me? He said, where are you? I said, I'm at the office. Well, he said, I'm kind of busy today. I have some records to play. And I thought, golly, that's strange for anybody to be playing records on a Saturday afternoon. Really strange. But this thing inside of me was very insistent, and I persevered, and I said, Ross, I really must see you. Will you please come? And, of course, you know what he did. He said, yes, I'll be there. See? We have a means of communication. There is a level of communication between alcoholics which goes without words or goes above words or around words. See, when the cry for help is there, we go because we have to go. And he came. I had to see another client, and I did see another client. And by the time I was finished that client, my little stenographer came in to me, and she said, there's a man here to see you. His name's Ross. Let's see it. And he came walking into my office. And you know, that guy had me from the very beginning. He didn't say a word. He just stuck out his hand, but there was a light in his eye and a kind of a look on his face, the confidence, the knowledge. I knew he knew what I had to know. The only thing he said to me was, have you got trouble? Man, did I qualify? I had trouble. I had every kind of trouble there was to have. So he sat down, I sat down. He had told me that he would have maybe 20 minutes to spare for me that day. He was busy. That was about noon when he got there. He went home at 9:30 that night. We spent 9 hours together or more, I'm sure. Told me all about alcoholism, told me the story of Alcoholics Anonymous, told me all about Bill W. Fantastic. Told me all about me. I don't know what it was precisely that he said. I don't remember any specific word he said, but whatever it was he told me, it changed my entire life, my whole attitude towards life, my attitude towards myself, towards my family, towards my business, towards the rest of mankind. It all changed in the space of one afternoon. That normal? Does something like that happen in the absence of a spiritual experience? Somewhere in the writings of Carl Jung, it says that what we look for are massive changes of personality and attitudes. And I feel absolutely sure that's what happened. That's what was done to me that afternoon. So when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous in crisis, as I did, as flat as I was, it's not very hard to surrender. I didn't do any surrendering. It was done to me. I got surrendered. I came in like that. I didn't know for 6 months that it could be any other way. I was wrong about everything, and I knew it. There was no fight left in me whatsoever. So when I read those words in the big book that says, we have ceased fighting everything and everybody, I knew that they were intended for me, and I knew they described me beautifully, because that's exactly what I was like. So it's no wonder that my wife was able to notice a little difference. Isn't that amazing, from one day to the next, that it would happen like that? I had nothing to do with that. And the first night I went to the meeting. It was on Monday night. Ross didn't say he would take me. He said, I'll meet you there, and he did. He said to me, you're going to buy one of those books. He handed me this thing. He said, give me $5. It's yours. And he said, look at it. Read it. And he put his grubby little finger on the first preface, the preface to the original edition, and said, look at these words. We, of Alcoholics Anonymous, are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I thought, oh boy, they're talking about me. They're talking about me. He said, not those words, the next ones. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And he said, don't you ever forget that. This is where it is. It's in here. And he told me about the program and explained it all to me so carefully. So we got three legacies in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got recovery, unity, service. And they're not three different parts of anything. They're just three different sides of the whole, three aspects of the same thing. And without recovery, you got nothing. Without unity, your recovery is not operable. You can't recover for you. You got to recover for somebody else. And service is the operation of the first two legacies. Love in action. I'd been sober maybe a week. Took me out to jail. This time, sober. And he said, this little jail meeting needs a sponsor and you're going to be it. And I thought, God, I'm getting something to do, you know. And they'd ask me, how do you like that jail meeting? And I didn't really like it, you know, because the doors would clang and I didn't enjoy seeing men in cages. It bothered me, you know. And I kind of wanted to find a reason to get out of it, but I had felt a loyalty to him. He had given me so much. You know, and then the realization came to me that he didn't really like it either. It bothered him too. But it was part of the price that he was willing to pay for the dividends of sobriety, and he never counted it for one second. The only question he ever had in his mind was, where do I have an opportunity to take this message? I didn't even feel like going to mental homes either. That bothered me in the beginning. I thought the smell was funny. I thought they were kind of funny people. I was at one about a month ago at Selkirk, Manitoba. It's a big mental institution, and we have a beautiful meeting there, and they're wonderful, wonderful people. They're so warm, and they're so full of love, you know. One of the little girls at this meeting called me a sexy senior citizen. How do you like that? I don't know what the hell I did, but I'm going back to find out. Well, I remember a new one out there the other day. We have another home, which is for retarded children. For anybody who might have this experience, you might think about it. Because they're retarded children, they have to have three staffs, three shifts a day, 8 hours each, you know. So if they've got 200 retarded children, they have a staff of about 600, and that's just about the case here. I've been invited there three times by the director to go and talk to the staff about alcoholism. Because the degree of emotional strain on the staff is so great, the incidence of alcoholism among that staff is a way, way, way above normal. This has never happened to me anywhere. I went out there to talk to these people on the illness of alcoholism and, you know, what alcoholism is. And six people there, we thought there were going to be 30, 240 people showed up. It was just incredible. Six people right in that meeting came up to the front and said, I want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. Has that ever happened to you? I almost died. I've never seen that before anywhere. One of them was a nurse going to the group, Porter's Recovery, and really enjoying it. Another one was a social worker. Another one was a psychologist. Another one was a plumber. You see, anybody at all can get alcoholism. So Ross was good. He pitched me into every kind of service, intergroup, conferences. Then somebody made me a GSR. Then I got to be an area committee man. Then one day somebody said to me, you're going to be delegate. Go to New York. And oh my God, I was scared. How's the time going? What time did I start, you know? Was it today? What day is it? 10 to 10. I'm got lots of time, haven't I? We're not going anywhere, are we? No. It was a bed. It was even done. I think there was a big machine out there, all right? roads in as an area committee man, because that gave me a chance to get into district work, you know, and do a little organization and redistricting and things like that. It was fantastic. We're having a general service conference in Calgary 10 days from now, and we're putting on a district committee demonstration. One of the district committees is going to come in and put on a demonstration of a district committee meeting. I think this is fantastic. I think we should share these things. I don't know about you, but I would love to see something like that at one of our international conferences. I think we have to become more service conscious because of these three legacies which we have. We can't ignore any part of them. I've always been impressed by a little talk that Dr. Bob made when he, in the beginning, explained how he came to get sober. And what the difference, he said, was service. You know, he and Bill both belong to this Oxford movement. They've both been trying to get the same spiritual principles. Bill had been having a hell of a time getting the spiritual principles. Bob was gobbling them up. He loved them, thought it was great. Bob was drunk all the time. Bill was sober. When Bob went with Bill to carry the message to another alcoholic, he got sober. And he stayed sober. The difference, he said, was service, carrying the message. At whatever level, in whatever capacity you can have. I try to stress this everywhere I go because I believe in it so firmly. I think it's such a terribly important thing. It's the thing that completes the circle. I think we need the best recoveries we can get. And I don't know of any way to get a recovery that's meaningful other than the way it's set out in this book. And I think there's a specific reason for that. Because when we get recovered as the result of the formula, the program that is set out in our 12 steps, what happens is what it talks about in the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result. Not a result. There isn't any other result. That's the purpose. And having had that spiritual awakening, having had that spiritual experience, I am absolutely certain, came to me not as a result of the thing that happened to me the day I was sitting there and picked up that glass. That wasn't it. It happened to me at some time, some day, some night, some morning, that I will never know, when I was sitting there looking at some drunk who's shaking it off and trying to figure out a way to help him to get sober. And it happened to me without my even knowing it, and I wouldn't have it any other way, knowing me. It couldn't happen to me any other way, and I'm so grateful for that. So we need good recoveries. Lots of good recoveries. Because unity of our fellowship through the traditions only comes on the basis of a good recovery. I know guys who are sober, but they're not recovered. They're still fighting with their wives. I got a dandy. I know him real well. I'm sponsoring him. I know every reason there is in the world for fighting with your wife. He's a very ingenious chap, you know. His wife is like my wife. She doesn't want anything big from him. She wants what my wife wanted. She wanted a little love and understanding, too. She wanted a little bit of the language of the heart. She wanted a little bit of patience. Oh, that was a good one. I went to a friend of mine who was a priest with that one. You know, I'm very impatient with my wife. I'm very impatient with my children. Wow, did he let me have it. He said, Tom, you're not impatient with your family. You don't love them enough. Boy, I walked out of there hating him for a day or two, I'll tell you. But I sat down and thought about it. And I went and talked to old Ross about it. I came to the conclusion he was absolutely right. Because there was no service there. None at all. I wasn't doing anything for my family. You know, bringing home grocery money is not love. That's duty. That's got all kinds of other names, but it sure isn't love. No way is it love.
Bob said the whole thing boiled down to love and service, two simple words. And I think he's right. I'm convinced he's right. If we go back and look at those six little points that we talked about in the beginning that were referred to in that pamphlet, you know, that pamphlet said, your general service conference. And then underneath, in smaller print, it had these words. It said, will you accept it? Because that was in 1950, and they were asking the Brotherhood, they were asking the Fellowship, the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, will you accept the Third Legacy Plan? Will you send delegates to New York? Will you adopt this procedure? And AA came back with an emphatic yes and said, we want to do it that way. And we've had it now every year for those 22 years, panel 22 this year. And we're learning how to operate it. Thank God we had that for 20 years before Bill disappeared, before Bill left us. Because we have now a backlog of experience. We've got a backlog of his advice and his leadership. I'm convinced, as I'm convinced I'm standing on this stage tonight, that that man was divinely inspired. I don't think he possessed the power, but I sure do think the power possessed him. I'll never forget the first time I met him. I'm like any other drunk. Boy, the thrills ran up and down my spine like that. It seemed to me like he was looking right through me, you know. I'm sure I didn't wash my hand for a month. But what really killed me was what he said to me when somebody introduced me. He said, I'm grateful for your sobriety, service, love, warmth, caring for others, having the welfare and the state of being of the other person at heart and caring about it. That's what this is all about. So it's true that Bill and Bob are not immortal, but they certainly have left us with much. Trustees almost unknown to the membership. I think this is less and less true, and I'm so grateful for that. We've had some fantastic trustees, some really dedicated, wonderful, marvelous people who have done much for our fellowship, of course without recognition, which is how it should be, and nobody would want to change it. Then the third proposition was that somebody or something should take the place of Bill and Dr. Bob, and I think this is happening, eh? We have the General Service Board, we've got the General Service Conference, we have our General Service Office, and thank God, most of all, we got you. We got you. We got you, and we got your groups, and we got your GSRs, and we got your intergroup representative, and we got that guy in your group who's making coffee and selling tickets, you know, peddling grapevines, doing the whole bit. See? This is all part of it. It's all part of it. AA has a right and a duty to take direct responsibility. This is a departure. Our whole program says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. We made a decision. We came to believe. It's a we program. But our responsibility oath, our responsibility creed says, I am responsible. And thank God for that. So I think we have it, you know, that AA has a right and duty to accept responsibility. And I think we're doing it. We have some fantastic people. And we've got all the beautiful people like you who are here. You didn't come here to evade responsibility, I know that. You came here to share and enjoy and accept whatever responsibility might be given by the program to you. And it says that the General Service Board must be firmly anchored in the fellowship. How glad I am to see what has transpired on the board. We have 21 trustees, 14 of whom are alcoholics. And where do they come from?
that come from the fellowship. People like Jack M., Jack Meager. Imagine that. We got a trustee. He's a university professor. He's sitting on our board, and he don't even know how the hell to pronounce his own name. His name is Mahar. It's a fine old Canadian-Irish name. They own a great big brewery. Wonderful family. He calls it Meager. And Tom is here, and Jim recently left us. And I'm going to miss that bird, I'll tell you. Because when I got to the board, he took me under his wing, and he shepherded me, and he sponsored me. Another one of my sponsors. I've had him everywhere I've gone in my whole life. God looks after that, you know. So I think maybe the board is anchored in the fellowship. I could talk to you about the nuns for days and days. Dr. Jack, who was supposed to be here, and bless his heart, he's not able to be. And that's too bad. And Travis Dancy from Montreal, who's a psychiatrist, we suggest to him that he's badly in need of some of his own treatment. But he takes it all in good part, and he's a dedicated human being, believe me. And a guy like Milton Maxwell, I was talking to him up in New York a week or 10 days ago, and we were talking about those principles which underlie successful groups and which are so necessary to a successful group. And Milton told me, he's been researching this for over 20 years, he's been giving of his time to Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not an alcoholic, he does it just because he loves it and he loves us. He does it out of love, you know, service in action. He says it's the warmth, it's the quality of caring, it's the openness of the group. If you have a group which makes it easy and possible for people to come there and open up their personalities and say, look, this is me. I have nothing to hide. I have nothing to fear. I'm getting better. I'm getting over this. Spill it out. Ventilate completely. If you can create that kind of a warm, happy atmosphere in a group, you're well on the way. I love discussing AA with this guy. He's got such a fantastic understanding of it. Wrote an article on anonymity in 1955. What were you doing in 1955? I know what I was doing. I was doing my best to get drunk, doing my best to kill myself. This guy was thinking about anonymity. And he still is. And then it says, the Journal Service Board has need of the direct support of the membership. And I agree with that 100%. I'm not thinking so much in terms of money. We don't run around talking about money as much anymore. Keep sending it. We love it. We talk about love. I talk about love. We need that. Give us that. Give us all the love you can, because love precedes service, and we need your service. We need it desperately. You need it. I need it. The board needs it. AA needs it. So give. Give freely of it. What have you got that you can give to Alcoholics Anonymous in terms of service? How much can you love? Here's a test of love. Not self-love. That kind of love that has absolutely no price tag. You're not going to gain by this monetarily. But you're going to gain in stature. And that's what that means, that sign back there. Serenity through sobriety, through active sobriety, through living this program. It's an action program. It's not something you go home and talk about. It's something you do. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We don't lay down any rules and say you got to do it like that. We're told that God will continue to disclose more to you and to us. And I believe that. It tells us to ask Him in our morning meditation what we can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if our own house is in order. But we have to make sure that our own relationship with Him is right. You know, that it's as open and honest and direct as I can make it open and honest and direct. If we're willing to share the little bit that we've got,
You know, you hear the guy in the group saying, well, I'm not ready for 12-step work yet. I can't do that. I can't go 12-step. I've only been dry 3 years. I can't. I don't know how. Nobody knows how. We got a chapter about it in our book that knows how. Read that. And take your heart in your hand and go. That guy may not get sober, but you'll stay sober. If we do this as openly as we can, great things will come to pass for you, for me, and for countless others. We're told this is the great fact for us. So that if I can abandon myself to the power, God as I understand him, some people can't say that because they're rebels. So they say, God as I do not understand him. And I don't think it matters at all. I don't think it matters. As long as the abandonment takes place, that's the important thing. And that's all that's important. Admit my wrongs, my faults, to him and to you. Open, warm communication. I don't have to be anything special. I'm just me, baby. And if you can't stand that, and if you don't like that, that's your problem, because this is how it is. And it is not about to change overnight. You know, we're trying. And then it says, join us, the unity, in this program, the oneness in the whole fellowship, you and I and each and every one of us. Now, we're not going to join in any sort of political movement or any kind of social movement or any kind of medical movement to improve the state of mankind, you and I. We're not in that kind of business. The only union, the only unity we're going to have is the spiritual kind. And that's the deepest kind. Because it's the only kind that's strong enough to reach into that place in the drunk which is disjointed insanity and put it back together again so that he can come and get what you and I were so free to give. So that maybe having this, you and I could go out and look into the face of alcoholism, whoever might be wearing it on that particular day, and have the ability to look through the blood and the sweat and the tears and the filth and the grime and the loneliness, the unhappiness, the fear, despondency, and breathe in a little bit of love. So that last guy or gal can come into the program and walk along hand in hand with you and I, sharing this thing to whatever degree. To me, this is the most beautiful thing in the world. To me, this is the most realistic, the most practical. It's as hard as that. It doesn't exist in any ethereal sense. It's real, and it's wonderful. To me, it's the central fact of life. I recall quite a number of years ago, there was a little group on Broadway made up of two professionals whose names were Rodgers and Hammerstein. They wrote songs and lyrics for songs and wrote Broadway shows and put things on like that. They had written a show for a lady whose name was Mary Martin. She was performing in this show. And she was a very gracious and kind and understanding lady, a lady of great spiritual depths. And they had become very, very close and very great friends. They had a keen appreciation and love for each other. One day at the theater, Hammerstein told them that he had received news from his doctor that he had to go to the hospital the next day for some rather serious treatment, and he indicated to them that this was a very serious problem. So they had a little meeting. They talked about this. And of course, I was not there, and I don't know, but I'm sure they prayed about it. And as he was leaving, he handed Mary Martin a little note, and then he went to the hospital. Of course, they found out the next morning that things had not gone very well, and that Hammerstein was no longer with them. There had been a break in the unity of the group. They were no longer one. So Mary took the paper out of her pocket and opened it up. It was to have been the lyrics for a new song that he was writing for her, and it read like this. It said, "A bell is no bell till you ring it. A song is no song till you sing it. The love in your heart was not put there to stay, for love is not love till you give it away." Thank you. God bless you.